session number 265-42, Reel 3.
Stan Hancock's Reel 3. How old were you when you left school?
Well, I was, let me see, 1941 I left school.
Had you taken any exams?
I took what they called the general school's certificate in those days. And if you got 40% in your subjects, you got the school certificate. And if you got 50% in all your subjects, you got what they called matriculation exempt. I'm not sure what all that meant, but I, as I say, we all sat, and then we had to leave school at 16 anyway, and I got a job as a transport clerk until I was such times as I joined the Navy, because I volunteered for the Navy, and I'd, because I wasn't 18, I volunteered as a regular. And eventually got called up into the Royal Navy, and I was 16, or just over 16 anyway. And I joined, and I was called what they...
Sorry, your foot is hitting the table.
I was what was called a boy first class.
When did you join the Navy exactly?
I joined in October 1942. So I was a boy first class.
Can you tell me, before we move on to that, exactly what happened to you when you joined, what the process was that you had to go through, and what happened to you after that?
Well, initially I went down and volunteered at the recruiting station. I was given a medical then, and sent back home, and said, you know, you will be hearing from us. And eventually I did get my call-up papers, and they said, report to this particular drill hall in Hornley with a small case containing toilet materials, a change of underwear, and what else? Change of underwear, toilet materials. Oh, and... a top coat. So, I went down there, and there were a lot of other people there with me. Some had been called up in the natural course of events because they'd reached 18, and there were many like myself who had joined up as regulars, if you like. Although in the Navy they were called active service. Although everybody was on active service, those of us that sort of joined on for a stipulated period of time were called active service. Everybody else that was called up were called HOs, which was short for hostilities only. So there was a distinction there. You're either active service or you're an HO. And then I suppose the oldest one, or the one that looked the biggest, was given charge of what they called the draft. And said, right, take all these now and report to this particular establishment. And off we went. And I remember we caught buses down to Acton Station and a tube train up to Waterloo. And Waterloo, to Portsmouth or Havant, forget now. Anyway, there were a load of lorries lined up waiting to take us off to HMS Collingwood, which was the training establishment. When we got there, we were separated. The HOs went to one training area, and active service chaps went to another training area. We were met then by instructors in the drill halls, as they called them, and we were separated then into various... Because, you see, there were an awful lot of people on this. Every week there was a big draft intake, and they were then... broken down into all sorts of things, and because we were active service and there weren't too many of us, we were split into two classes, and the training area at HMS Collingwood was split into various areas rather like a warship. You had the forecastle, which on a warship is the front part. Then you had the quarterdeck, which is the back half. Then you had the main top, which was between the two. And what was the other one? No, the foretop and the main top. So we had forecastle, foretop, main top, and quarterdeck. And I and several others were put in the forecastle division. And so for our training, we were forecastle division. And we were put into a hut with double bunks. And that was it. You were issued with your bedding for the first night. You were still in your civilian clothes. Then the following morning, at 6 o'clock, the bugle went. And because I, being a seeker, or had been a seeker, that I knew something of the naval routine anyway, you see, so I'd got a pretty good idea what it was all about. And there were one or two of us anyway that had been sea cadets, you see. So we tended to, if you like, react instinctively to what was going on and what was expected of us. Because in the sea cadets, you see, we'd done one or two or several camps, if you like, during our period with the sea cadets. We'd done training in the Ronover Barracks at Portsmouth, been up to Grimsby, been down to Chatham. So we knew something about the naval routine. So, okay, at 6 o'clock we heard the bugle and out, we turned and, you know, you washed and got it back into your civilian clothes because we hadn't been issued with a uniform yet. And then we formed up outside with the instructor. And then we were marched to the parade ground, and we were then allocated various duties about sweeping up the drill sheds and things like that until breakfast, and then we marched back to the mess hall for breakfast, where we were given our breakfasts, and then we had to go tidy up the hut that we were sleeping in, make sure the beds were okay, and this was all fine. But once we done all that, and at 9 o'clock we went to what they call divisions. That's when everybody's on parade for colours, when they raise the colour and they play the national anthem. Fear God, honour the King again, you see. And then you were marched off to your various instructions. But of course we were at this end of the training, and of course all those, they went through to various end of training. So we were marched off then to have a medical again. We were all given another medical. We were then formed up and marched off and given our uniforms. So we were given all our uniforms. We were then taken somewhere else and we were given official bedding. That was two hammocks, a mattress, two mattress covers, and a blanket. And all this was piled onto us. We shoved it all in a big kit bag or rolled up into the hammock, and we were marched again to have it all marked. And in this marking shed, there were some pensioners that had been called back. They'd done their time in the Royal Navy, and they'd all been through the First World War, and most of them had seen service in the Second anyway. But they were there, and they, as you went up, they asked you your name and your service number, which we'd already been given anyway, and so they stamped all your gear with your name and your service number with black paint or ink, as the case might be. We were then taken back to our hut and said, right, lay out your kit on your bed, and the instructor was then telling us how in future the bed had to be made up. You know, your blankets had to be folded separately, your hammock separately, your mattress separately, and it was all piled at the end of the bed. And at this stage we only had lockers just to put our gear, you know, our uniform in. So we put all that away, and he said, well, in future, when you get up in the morning, that's how your beds have got to be made up. And that was fine. He said, now, get into your uniform. Well, as I said earlier, there's two or three of us have been cadets anyway, so we knew exactly what to do with our uniform and others. Because we used to say in the Navy, you dress like a horse. if it doesn't come over your head, it comes over your bottom. There was the white front, there was the sailor's collar, there was your jumper, there was your trousers. They all had funny buttons. But we got into our uniform and then we helped all the others to get into theirs, you see. And then put the silk round, which was supposed to be in mourning for Nelson, then a lanyard, which a knife was attached to, and then a little round hat, with the captain, which was the name, HMS, it just had HMS on it. The several of us that have been sea cadets, we could tie what was called a reef bow. That was where you tie the ribbon over your left ear. And if you tied an ordinary bow, it wasn't correct, because you had to have the two tails at the top and the two bows at the bottom. And then it's called a reef bow. And unless you're told how to do it, it becomes a mess. So we explained all this to these chaps, and they began to realise that if they wanted to know anything, then I think there were three or four of us, I'm sure, I can't remember. I know there were certainly three of us, because, you know, we used to have our own little, which unit were you in? You know, I was in Richmond Sea Cadets, or I was in Kingston, or something like that, you see. So we were already friendly, if you like, and we'd formed OPOs. Which is a naval expression for opposite number, which is a pal, really. who's your best oppo? So we became oppos anyway. Then the instructors then had us all out in front of the hut, lined up. But at this stage, we hadn't learned to march, or we hadn't been instructed in anything like that, you see. And I can remember him, we called out in front, and he said, my name is Leading Seaman Trigg. He said, I'm only a leading seaman, he said, but you've got to call me sir, because I'm your instructor. So he said, I'm always sir. And so he said, now on, in threes, he said, we're going off now. And then we went off to the pay office, and by this time they'd given us our pay books. They were ready for us to pick up anyway. So we got our pay books with our official numbers and all this, and you had to try and remember what your official number was. And then we started our course of training, which lasted for 10 weeks. We were issued with gaiters, which, you know, they go around your the bottom of your trousers, around your ankles, the gaiters, and a khaki belt. And that was all. Then they took you through the 10 weeks of training, basically how to learn how to march, respond to words of command, rifle drill, boat drill, knots, rigging, climbing over the up the masts, all sort of seamanship skills, how to throw a deadline. And I could, because we were boy seamen and we joined up as regulars, and I thought this quite an anomaly. We were in the middle of a war, you know, fighting basically for our existence. But we were taught cutlass drill, because that was what a boy was taught. Cutlass drill. And I can remember on the first guard, second guard, third guard, all those sort of things. And anyway, we progressed through our training. It's divided into watches. I was forecastle division, as I mentioned, but there was a port and starboard side of it. And within the port and starboard separations, they called three watches, red, white and blue watches, because you were on duty one day out of three. So you would be doing guard duty one night, or all sorts of things you had to do, fire parties, on your duty night. And we weren't allowed any leave until we'd been in the establishment 8 weeks. Then, of course, it was liberty. They piped liberty from 1600 to, and because we were only doing initial training, we had to be back on board I say on board. It was a land establishment, but we were using naval expressions. You see, you had to be back on board at 2300, and Fareham was the nearest town we could get into. So of course, after 8 weeks, everybody wanted to go ashore, and then after 8 weeks, you became, if you like, the elite, because you went into. You came out of Focal Division, you went to Gunnery Division, because in those days, you know, big guns ruled the Royal Navy, and everybody had to know how to man a gun, whether it was an ordinary Lewis gun or whether it was a turret, a 15-inch gun. You were taught all the aspects of naval gunnery, the types of shells that you used, the settings on the shells, whether they were high-explosive, armour-piercing, and... You also, once you became Gunnery Division, you were formed part of the Guard, and that meant that every morning at 8:45 you would form up outside your hut with your rifle and bayonet and all your webbing on, and you would be called to attention, present slow arms, right turn, and then you would march onto the parade ground. And of course, by this time, all the new entrants had come in, you see, and you could say, well, we used to be there when we first joined, and then we were there, then now we're in, you know, we're the bees knees. We've nearly finished our training, and the change that took place within that period of training, you know, you were smart, you were coordinated, you were proud, all these things, and you marched in front of the flagpole, and you were halted, and you were turned left, facing the foe. You were dressed to make sure you stood in your straight lines, and then you would wait and wait for colours. And the one of the officers would go up to the captain, and he would say, 2 minutes to colours. And he'd salute him. And then the Royal Marine bugler would stand forward from the band, and another officer would say, 9 o'clock, colours. And the captain would then make it so. And the officer of the guard would say, guard, general salute, present arms. We'd all present arms. And the Royal Marine band would play the national anthem while they hoisted the white ensign. And when the white ensign was hoisted, we would come to slope arms, and then order arms, and then stand at ease. Then we'd have divine service, just prayers and a hymn. Then we would be called back to the attention. And when we're at the attention, the Royal Marine bugler, who had already left the band earlier on, would then sound off the punishment call. Because even in a training establishment, people stepped out of line and they had to be punished for it. And so he would sound the punishment call for all the men under punishment. And those... excuse me, that would go before the captain or the commander to be punished before that. And then we would march off again, all the divisions would be march off to their instructions. We would march off, return our rifles, and then carry on with the rest of our training, you see. And then, of course, the big day came when you finished your training. By this time, everybody knew how to put a uniform on. And of course, they tried to make it as smart as they thought it would be. Of course, generally speaking, in those days, the Royal Navy uniform it wasn't what we call tiddly. You know, it didn't fit or anything like that. See, so as soon as it was possible, you went to a tailor or a naval tailor, and he would tailor it to suit you. And anyway, that was that.
Can I ask you, how did you adjust to the lack of privacy and the discipline of the Royal Navy?
Oh, I just accepted it. Didn't think about it. You didn't think about it. You say, lack of privacy. You go into the showers, you see, and you're all there. You're all in the noddy. One or two people who, you know, in those days would think, oh, that's off. You know, they probably had private education or something like that, because everybody was thrown together. You're in a melting pot. And some of the chaps that we were with, it can't be read or write. And I can remember one chap, he'd never seen a flashing loo. No, we had them, you see. He thought, oh my goodness, mate, you know, that's how the other half lives. But they were all thrown together. And, you know, you make the most of it. As I said, you go in the showers, and the instructor would be there, and you'd have to do your own washing, or dobing, as we called it. I think that's an Indian expression, dobi wala. We call it dobi, and you'd wash all your underclothes and whatever it would need to be washed, you see, and take it to the drying room, because they were very clean on personal cleanliness. You know, you come out of the shower and you go in and you'd stand in front of the instructor, say, am I clean, sir? And you turn around, and it's all part of the routine, the ritual, if you like. Because basically the training was to break you. They broke your spirit, and then they rebuilt it up again, and you responded to them. You didn't query, because that had all knocked out of you. You had to act on the word of command, and the only way to do that was to break whatever resistance you had as an individual, not to question it. So you were all broken. It was done very humanely, and you didn't realise it at the time that it was going on. But subsequently you thought, well, crikey, you know, what is, yes, of course they knocked it all out of us in initial training. Because it came instead, you didn't question, later on I might tell you a story, you know, where people would have, well, I'm not going to do that, but you did it, because it was instinctive, you were acting under orders. But anyway, the big day came, and you were going on leave, and you'd got into your best gear, and you'd learned to pack your kit bag, and you'd learned how to lash up your hammock, and that was put in the bedding store, and you went on your first leave, and of course you were proud of punch.
That was after the initial training?
Yeah, after your training, yes. Yeah. And you were proud of punch, and you were... The class that was going on leave, you'd been right through this. They'd broken you and they'd built you up again. You'd gone in there as, in our case, young lads, and you were coming out as trained seamen, trained men. And so, of course, the Royal Marine Band was there, and all the other classes were lined up on the playground. But you had qualified, you were now going to rejoin the fleet, or join the fleet, and you were marched out of the barracks there behind the Royal Marine Band into the lorries to the side, and off you went home, because they'd given you a travel warrant wherever you lived. And that's it, and you were going home, and that was it, on your first leave.
What was your family's reaction, and particularly your mother's reaction to you joining up at that early age?
She accepted it. She accepted it. Because the fact is that Dennis and Leslie and my father were still in the services. And it was a natural thing for me to go along. But no, she was rather proud of me that I didn't have to be called up. Because a lot of people, you know, they waited to be called up. They didn't mind going when the time came, but they weren't, you know, too happy to put themselves on the line, if you like, before they had to. So it was a bit of personal, you know, oh, my son didn't have to be called up, you know, they went, you know. So there was a little bit of a personal pride there, not only with my mother, but with a number of, because, as I said earlier, you know, we used to go to church quite regularly, so everybody knew everybody. I see your son's gone into the Navy, or he's gone into the Army, or he's been called up to the Air Force. Oh, yes, but he didn't have to be worried, didn't he? He wasn't called up. volunteered, you know. It was a bit of a kudos. So, yes, I think Mum accepted it. If she didn't accept it, she never showed it. She never showed it. She supported me all the way, did Mum. Yes. Because I think within our road where I lived, people who were in the Army or the Air Force, I was the only one going to the Royal Navy. And of course, you know, Jolly Jack, all the nice girls, like I said, all those sort of things, and the Navy being a senior service, I thought Mum probably thought it was something, you know, Stanley's having the Royal Navy, he's a sailor.
What happened to you after your first leave home?
After I went after the first leave, of course, I went back to the barracks, and I was drafted to a destroyer called HMS Icarus, which at that time was with the 14th Escort Group, and she was lying in Londonderry, Northern Ireland. And I joined a draft for them. And I can remember we were given sandwiches and an apple. We were taken on lorries to Portsmouth Station. And from Portsmouth we came up to London and more lorries laid on. And we were taken across to Euston, I think it was. Because we had to catch a train to Stranraer. To catch the ferry from Stranraer to Larne, which was an overnight journey. So we caught this train and got to Stranraer, caught the ferry across the Larne, and from Larne we caught a train ground to Londonderry. And from Londonderry there were lorries that took us to the dockyards at Lissahammy. HMS Icarus was lying alongside. I said the 14th Escort Group. We were with initially the 6th Canadian Escort Group, that's right. Because we were the only British ship with there were the Canadian ships. And anyway, we drew up alongside, and there were four of us on draft to the Icarus. And we joined the Icarus, reported to the coxswain with our draft jets. We were given a mess. I was in two mess, which was a seaman's mess.
So you were no longer a boy?
I was still a boy seaman. And I was a boy seaman then until I was 17 and a half. You put in the mess. You were registered. I haven't mentioned this before. Once you finished your initial training and you became a trained seaman that you were drafted to, you had three options. Whenever you joined anything, part of the joining routine, you were either G's, which stood for grog, which meant that you were 20 years of age and you could draw your tot. You were T, which was temperance, and for which you got sovereigns a day instead of your grog. Or you were UA, which meant underage. And I was always UA, you see. Like most of us were in those days. You were UA. So they weren't very keen on having you in a mess as a UA, because that meant there was no top being drawn on your behalf, you see. Because what they used to do, when they would draw the rum, the rum bosun would draw the rum at 11:30, they would put the more rum there was, the more water they would put in to make it go further, you see. So, because if you had a mess of, say, 20 people, and only 16 were drawing rum, there wasn't a lot. But if 18 were drawing rum, there were two extra tots, you see.
Stan Hancock's Reel 4.
Good Lord, we back on.